children. We're starting.
That's right.
Showtime. Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. With Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 72 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2.com. With me on the line once again, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Good morning, mate. I'm well. I'm fighting to get everything done before the expo starts tomorrow here in Melbourne. Otherwise, well, everybody seems to be asking me to do lots of stuff this year. And of course, every year when the photo expo hits, I've got a lot to do. I've got a stand for the Total Image magazine to run, and then of course appointments to make with all the people in the industry I need to speak to. Yep. But this year I've been asked also to lecture on a Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And also I've got to create a DVD for Coke and Filters for the for the stand at Coke and this year, for the Coke and part of the expo this year, and I still haven't finished that. Lots to do. To do. So dear listeners, today I'm going to make it a little shorter than usual, so you'll have to forgive me. I'll make it twice as long next week. How's that?
I think I'll survive.
Yeah, I probably ramble on too much anyway. But thank you all for once again checking in with us here at audio2u.com and Shutters Inc. First of all, let me just say to you, Paul, our man who likes to head off to powwows and take pictures.
Paul Ballen or a different Paul?
Paul Gowder.
Gowder, right.
Yes, he has sent us some photographs, having taken on board the comments and suggestions we made for flash and rear curtain sink and all that kind of thing. Paul, this is what Paul said. He said, tried some shots with rear sink, but didn't really like the results. I'm going to have to continue to experiment with that. Well, Paul, that's the whole idea.
I can relate to that because I tried a few as well and I wasn't absolutely blown away.
No,
I think it just takes practice.
It does. It's a matter of the right shutter speed combined with the action and the right flash exposure. It is a trial and error thing, and nobody gets it right all the time, but keep trying it. I think for what you do, Paul, it would be fabulous. I would only suggest, having seen the pictures that you sent through, that you perhaps wait till things get a little darker. If you tried it in the very bright circumstances that you did, you probably wouldn't get very happy results. If it's slightly darker, of course, there's less to actually burn in, and you get not quite so much blur and a little bit more sharpness. But the pictures that you sent in now are what I would say an improvement on what you sent in before, Paul. You've really mixed your flash with your ambient light very well, so you hardly notice that the flash is present, and I think it's really great. Although you say you were disappointed when you were looking at the raw files at the sharpness. Am I being too hard on myself, or can I make them sharper? I don't. Look, you've sent me a couple of JPEGs there, and they seem fine to me. But movement and flash and rear curtain sync and all that kind of thing, it's very hard to get crispness out of everything. I mean, the whole idea is about blur, so it's very hard for me to judge. But personally, I thought they were fine. So Paul, well done. Kudos to you for giving that a try. Keep working with flash, because it is a fabulous tool, as we've already talked about, and you can create some wonderful effects with it. You really can.
It's interesting that you bring up the whole fill flash thing, because on the weekend, just gone, was Kath's and my fifth wedding anniversary, and we went away for the weekend up to the Central Coast. And I was mucking around with some fill flash while Kath and Max were in the swimming pool, where I had the sun setting behind the pool, and I was using fill flash to just fill in their faces. And from a variety of distances, from 2 meters to 15 meters.
Yeah.
And I was actually quite happy with some of the results that I got. So I might throw a couple of those up on the site for people to look at as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll send them down to you so you can have a look.
It'll be great. It's a great thing to see how people are taking on board the comments we've made and the suggestions we make on this podcast. It's very gratifying for you and I, because we know we're out there. When our listeners send back images and say, hey, got this great effect after having listened to the show, or got this great shot as a result of this tip that you've given, it makes our job all the more worthwhile here, because we know that you're benefiting and you're taking better pictures. And that's been something that I've love doing, helping people take better pictures for the last however many years. So it really is great.
And sometimes I find, you know, from my own experience of listening to you know, tutorials of any other variety, you know, that sometimes when you're listening to it, you get all fired up and you think, oh yeah, that's great, yeah, I'm going to try that. But then when you're on your own and trying to do it for yourself, sometimes it can be quite hard to implement what you heard, you know, back whenever you were listening or watching whatever tutorial it was. You know, so it is, as you say, it's gratifying to see that people are, you know, not only hearing it here, but then being able to go out with their camera when they're, you know, by themselves and just put it into practice and actually, you know, making it happen.
Yes, and it really is. Keep it coming, folks. It helps us to help you, which is the main thing. And I love it when people like Ken Tucker send in photographs and saying, "Hey, you know, don't think we're not listening because we are. I took this picture, and I remembered what you said when I took it, and it's great. It was a very lovely photograph you sent us, Ken. You know, seeing your comments there and seeing your photograph, it was really lovely. So thank you for sending that through." Thomas asked us a question. He says that I love the Ricoh GR, and I do. It's a beautiful camera, and I've really enjoyed using it. But he asks about noise in the sensor. Well, Thomas, there is a little more noise in the GR than perhaps working with, you know, the same camera as an SLR or a DSLR, because the sensor's smaller, the photo sites are closer. There's, you know, it's an 8 megapixel sensor, but it's much smaller than, say, an 8 megapixel sensor on a DSLR. So the heat and energy created as a result of having the photo sites so close together, yes, does increase noise. And that is an issue with compact cameras who have high level, you know, megapixel ratings.
So, question for you: does that also carry across to digital SLRs? If you've got, as an example, that's close to home, I've got the Konica Minolta 7D, which is a 6.3 megapixel. As we all know, Konica Minolta sold out to Sony. Have basically released their first digital SLR, which is the A1000, I think they call it,
or A100,
yeah. I mean, sorry. Now, in theory, I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that would have the same size sensor in it, because it uses the same sort of body form factor and the same lenses and whatnot.
Yes.
But it's a 10 megapixel, so does that mean it would more than likely create more noise because the photo sites are closer together on that 10 megapixel sensor as opposed to my 6.3 megapixel sensor?
The potential is certainly there, and this is something that you know, the guys in the white coats are constantly fighting. They want to increase the megapixel rating, because that's a selling point. It certainly
even
is.
Even though we all know we don't need it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've really got enough now.
It's
really
the recession we had to have.
That's right.
Only Australian listeners would get that.
It's the recession we had to have. Yes, if you'd lived in Australia in the 80s and early 90s, you'd remember that comment. That's the problem. In fact, I was talking to someone in the industry the other day, someone who works for Olympus, and of course they've just released, you know, a whole bunch of new SLRs, the E-series SLRs, and he was saying, you know, he sort of gave me this little, you know, look, and he said, you know, to be honest with you, 6 megapixels is probably the highest quality rating for the kind of cameras we're using now. Now, I don't know if he's true, but what he's basically saying is that when you offset the noise factor versus the increase in pixels, there's not really a great advantage. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, because I've certainly do love the fact that I'm shooting with a 10 megapixel camera, and it doesn't seem to have any increase in noise at the same ISO level as my 6 megapixel camera did.
Right.
But the potential is certainly there. And I know that I was speaking with one of the head marketing fellows at Nikon, and he was saying that it's not just about the sensor, but it's the technology that they also put in behind the sensor. For instance, there are two cameras that both have a 10 megapixel sensor, but the D200, which is the D40X and the D200, and even the D80, yes. But the D200 has more technology behind the sensor that improves the image. So it's not just the sensor, but there's a lot of technology behind it that they use to actually improve the image quality. So yes, there is an increase in noise when you pack more photo sites into a sensor, and especially when that sensor is smaller than, say, an APS-C size sensor, such as the sensors in your camera, Bruce, and mine. So therefore, you know, you will find that if, say, you'd go out and buy a GR, a Ricoh GR, Thomas, that you'll compare two images and find that, yes, the GR does have more noise, as do a lot of compacts in its class. I wouldn't necessarily say the GR has more noise than other compacts I've seen and worked with, but I'll tell you what, it's got a fabulous lens in it. And the noise that you see, you know, when you, you know, you bring it right up on screen, is not going to necessarily manifest itself in a print that you make. I've made some prints from the GR that have knocked me sideways and had them printed in magazines at the same time and seen no issues at all. So it really is, again, one of these let's get, you know, real situations. And I don't mean to insult you, Thomas, but we can worry about things that really, to the naked eye, don't matter all that much. The great idea about the Ricoh GR is that it is a great camera to have on hand. It functions like an SLR in terms of its control and has a fabulous lens on it and is just a fabulously built camera. I really love it. But I haven't noticed an issue that concerns me in terms of noise when you come right down to the basics of, let's make a print and let's have a look at it. I will be, one of my images is being used on the Ricoh stand this year at the Imaging and Technology Expo, and they're making it a few feet long by a few feet wide.
Wow.
Yeah, from the GR. It's a photograph that I took in Canada, the Rockies. It's a lake foreground with a mountain background, and they love it, and they're going to be blowing it right up, you know, to say, hey, look what this camera can do.
Nice.
And I don't think I'll be able to, I'll be looking at that from standard viewing distance. Now, let's get this clear. I will be looking at this from, you know, maybe 5, 6, 10 feet away or whatever and going, ha, look at my beautiful picture. Everybody stand around and look at my beautiful
Bask
picture.
Bask in my glory.
Please, I am. I am Shelton Muller, and there is my product. Please come, look, and I shall do.
Pay homage.
And so, yes, I don't think I'll be worrying about the noise in the picture. Because at standard viewing distance, I won't see it. I really won't see it.
Do you think the comments you were making earlier about compacts being more susceptible, is that some sort of function of the technology, or is it just because they're built to a price?
Well, they're built to a price. Yes, absolutely true. They have the... They understand that the consumer, the compact consumer, is going to, first thing he's going to ask is when he goes, you know, when he's presented with a camera on the counter. How many megapixels is it? Right. And so they know that's the mentality of buyers, and unfortunately, yeah, a mentality that is perpetuated by photo retailers. It's not, yeah, shouldn't be, but it is. And so they have this issue, but then they want to be competitive in price. So they can't throw a lot of technology into it at the back end to, yeah, reduce the noise. So that's why the GR in this country is about $800, because there's been a lot of technology and a lot of work thrown into it for a camera that doesn't even have a zoom, you know.
Yeah.
So it's it really is all of these things. But there's the simple physical factor that you've got a lot of photo sites, you know, 8 million odd photo sites to create a pixel, you know, each one creating a pixel in a very small sensor. So there's a lot of energy transfer between them, and therefore a lot of randomly colored pixels, which is what we call noise. So Thomas, don't let that put you off buying the camera, because I love mine, and anybody, I've spoken to some top-notch professionals in this country and interviewed them for my magazine, and all of them love the camera. Not one of them has said, oh, look, it's a bit noisy. The comments have been made about the noise, but only in relationship to the fact that they're working some with, like, you know, Bruce Pottinger in this country. He works with a 39 megapixel, you know, medium format camera.
Wow.
But he carries the GR around because he loves it, and he raves about it, as does, you know, Robin Hills, a prominent, you know, and Marcus Bell, two prominent wedding portrait photographers in this country, both of whom I've interviewed, both of whom love this camera. So let's just get things into perspective. It is what it is, and we use it for a particular purpose, and for that purpose it's beautiful. You know, and therein is really your answer. So don't let that get the better of you, Thomas. It's a great camera.
Have you got any more listener emails to address?
No.
Okay.
Only one from Nick, who asks about the Sigma 10-20, which I've heard some great reports about optically. My only concern with Sigmas, from personal experience and from friends, is I don't think it's as well constructed. They're as well constructed, and I've said this before, as perhaps they should be. I would suggest you also have a look at the Tamron 11-18, which I personally love, but great optical reports on the Sigma 10-20. That's about the best that I can give you in terms of an answer on that front. Anyway, right. There you go.
Because I have one more question without notice, and that is...
I love you, Bruce.
why is it that all of the digital SLRs have a slowest ISO of 100? Why can't we get a 50 ISO or a 25 ISO even on a digital SLR?
Probably because it wouldn't make much difference in terms of quality or noise. That's an interesting question.
No, but it would at least let you shoot slower shutter speeds in bright light.
That's true. That's very true. And let's look at that.
Maybe you could throw that one at some of the manufacturers at the exhibition in the next couple of days.
All right. Why not? Why not slower ISOs? That's a very good point.
Because I mean, I used to love shooting 25 ISO black and white and being able to take, you know, just longer exposures in broad daylight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you just can't do it with a digital.
No, you can't. Therein, and that is why you need a Kokin ND4 and a Kokin ND8 neutral density filter.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that's, I mean, as it might sound like a giggle, but and I appreciate you laughing because it was intended to be a bit of a giggle, but it really is true. You know, we still need filters within the digital age. We still do. So,
and I have an ND8 and an ND4. But... You know, all of those things add to the number of obstacles that the light has to pass through.
That's true.
So, you know, the preferred option would be to have a slower ISO rating on the digital SLR.
And I'll check into that for you.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I'll there'll be so many tech people at this gig on the weekend. So, I'll be able to get an answer to that question. That's for sure.
Excellent.
So, don't we move on to? Part one. What do you reckon, Bruce? Yep. Part one. Were you going to mention?
No.
You took a breath there?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Off
all right.
You... Don't let me stand in your way.
No, fair enough. Well, you know I never do. This is my podcast, not yours. All right. So, light, part one. Do we have any intro music?
No.
Okay. All right. We can edit that in later. No, fair enough. The reason that we've talked about light is as a result of a very kind comment that we received earlier about, you know, my images on my website and, you know, my use of light. And that is because, you know, I've learned over the years that light is the tool that we use to create images with. And that may sound rather obtuse and obvious, but you really don't understand that when you first pick up a camera. And I see the work of so many, you know, amateur photographers and friends who show me pictures that are beautifully composed or of beautiful things or beautiful people or whatever or interesting things, but the light's all wrong. And they can't actually pinpoint the problem with the image or where it does not necessarily shine, you know, where it doesn't necessarily excel as an image. Mm-hmm. And when I point that out, and I try not to, but if they ask, you know, I'll usually say, well, it's a lovely landscape. Perhaps next time you'd like to, you know, you should either get up earlier or get there a little later. And they go, oh, yeah. And I'll point out that, see, you're in the midday and you've got all this contrast and haze and all that kind of beautiful scene, but in the wrong light. Which basically goes to prove that the most beautiful thing photographed in the wrong light or placed perfectly within the frame, compositionally speaking, still will suffer as an image and not excel as an image because the light is wrong. So photographs are not necessarily about composition. It's light, not composition, that, in my opinion, really makes an image. Composition is very important, but I've seen poorly composed images or perhaps images that have not necessarily concentrated on composition but are nonetheless stellar pictures because of the nature of the light. Consider, you know, certain kinds of documentary photographs that are caught in grabs, you know, they're just grab shots, not necessarily brilliantly composed because of the nature of the situation in which the photographer found himself. It was a, you know, there it is, bang, grab the shot. But it was lit fabulously. The light on the subject creates a mood and emotion. You know, it's contextual, and therefore the image shines. So the reason we're going to be talking about light over the next few podcasts is because it is the key to our images, and there's so much to learn from it. Light is used to reveal shape. It's used to reveal form, you know, three dimensions in R2. It's used to reveal texture. And because we're a tactile species, you know, we immediately, if we've got something physical in our hands, our tendency is to feel it for texture. And if we can reveal that in a photograph, then we connect with the viewer at a very tactile and physical level. Light is also used to evoke or to reveal color. And also, light will alter the nature of color. Think of perhaps doing a portrait in under clouds, you know, or an overcast day, and then do a portrait in early morning or late afternoon light. The color of the skin will change dramatically because the color of the light. So we use light to reveal color, but not always in truth. Color is simply a reflection. All color is to the human mind is the part of the spectrum that is most dominant, or the combinations of color in the spectrum that is most dominant and, you know, is reflected off a surface. So we use light to reflect certain parts of the spectrum into our eyes and through to our mind, and the light that is used will, you know, the color of the light and the nature of the light that is used will alter dramatically the color of the subject. So we use that also to create interest. And we also use, as we've already mentioned, light to evoke emotion, to evoke mood and context. Try, for instance, and we often see this done, unfortunately, but try doing a romantic bridal portrait in blazing midday sun. It just doesn't work. You could have the couple beautifully posed. You could have the couple just, you know, you could have the image fabulously composed. They could be posing just perfectly. The setting could be wonderful. But if the light is wrong, then the photo just won't work. It just won't work. Case in point, and I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast. I don't know whether I was talking to you about it or on this podcast, Bruce, or whether I was just talking about it in conversation, but my nephew's wedding.
You sent us some of the photos.
Right.
They were great.
And I thank you. I think I might have mentioned this as a result of that we were at a place called the Briars, which is down the Mornington Peninsula here in Melbourne. And it's an old property of these people who moved here in the early 1800s. And they were personal friends of Napoleon Bonaparte. And there's a lot of Bonaparte stuff in the house.
Wow.
There's a guitar that he gave the family. There is a death mask, actually, of Napoleon Bonaparte in the house. There is locks of his hair. Paintings, original paintings of him as a younger man. Oh, wow. It's a fascinating place. But the property itself is great. Old homestead, beautiful vineyards, and just fabulous. And I go there wherever possible to shoot a wedding. But we turned up, and I just said, okay, we're going to stop right here at the gate. We hadn't even gone into the property, and we stopped at the gate. I got the car to stop and park, and I got everybody lined up. And if you go to the website, you can see that I photographed the bridal party and the bride and groom in the gates of this property. Now, the groom came up to me, my nephew, and he said, this is great. Are we actually going to go into the property, though? Are we going to, there's some really cool places in here. And I said, yeah, Jake, we will. But for the moment, I just want to stay right here, and I'll show you why. And I got him around the back of the camera. I showed him some of the pictures that I'd taken, and he didn't know why. But I just said, look, there you go. And he just saw, you know, these beautiful rim-lit photographs of him and his bride and the bridal party. And I just said, we're going to stay here for a minute. Is that okay? And he said, oh, these are awesome. Yeah, we're going to stay right here. I trust you. And he sort of realized that, hey, you know, I know what I'm doing. And what he didn't realize, and I didn't really want to explain for time, but, you know, because of time then, was that what he was seeing was the result of light.
Yeah.
Not location, not posing, not people, but light. And had we moved to another part of the property, I would not have got that effect. And what really mattered was not the beautiful homestead, not the beautiful grounds, but we were working with light. And so it was, you know, once again proven to me that that is, you know, that's the key. My philosophy, as I've often said on this podcast, is shooting a wedding, find the light and put them in it.
Yeah.
And that's all I did. That is really all I did, apart from a few basic composition and posing techniques. That's all I did. And he loves the photos, and so do I. So
yeah, no, they look great.
No, thank you. So it's light. It really is light, that, and not just composition, that makes an image. If you consider that a studio is designed not to control composition, but to control light. And photographers spend their lives learning how to work with studio lights.
Yeah.
You know, why is that? Because it is the light on the subject that makes the... If light was not important, why would we have not only studio lights, but all these light modifiers like softboxes and brollies and snoots and reflectors? If light was... If shooting a great portrait or a still life or you know, macro or whatever we're going to do in the studio was not dependent on light, why would we spend thousands and thousands of dollars on the gear to modify the light, direct the light, create the light, if all it was about was composition? You know, if all it was about was the subject, it's not. It, you know, studios are designed to control light, not composition. So let's take that, when we're shooting next, out into the field. And we're going to talk about how in the next few podcasts to do this. But let's say you are heading out and you've got your camera in hand and you are intent on taking a photograph. You have this mental picture of what you want to do because you've been to this place before, or you've been in this situation before, and you've got this mental predisposition, this pre-visualization of what you really want to achieve. But you get out there and you're setting it all up and it's just not working. I would suggest that one of the reasons it might not be working is because the light isn't with you. And either you've got to come back when the light is right and try again, or you've got to change your predisposition, your pre-visualization. You've got to change your mindset as to what you're achieving, because there is no way that you'll get the kind of image that you are seeing in your mind's eye, in your pre-visualized, you know, photo lab back there, unless the light is right. You just very rarely does that ever happen. We head out with an idea, and usually what we're seeing is not only the subject and its context, but the light in which that subject is bathed. And therein is the key. It's impossible to create an image without the right light, because light must match the subject and must match the intention that we intend, you know, our intention of the image, our intent behind it. And that's in terms of emotion, mood, and context, or shape, form and texture. So or even color. If the light isn't there, change the way you see it. And this is basically what we've done today, is talk in terms of principles about the importance of light. But I do that because if you understand the principle of it, if you understand that light is at the heart of your images, then over the next few weeks, as we discuss the nature of light and how to use it in certain contexts, if you've got this principle in your head that you can't work without it, and that light is everything, under that umbrella or within that context or principle, you'll be able to work with the specifics. If I do it the other way around, then it just won't work. And between now and next podcast, you are taking photographs, say to yourself, ask yourself this question: is the light right? Is the light congruent with my pre-visualized image or my predisposition?
My expectations.
Yes, my expectation. Is the light congruent with it? If not, change your expectation, or come back when the light is right, or if you're inside, create the right light. Because it really is at the heart of our images. The word photography, we all know what it means to write with light. And yet, even though that is what we know academically, but that the combination of those two Greek words mean, it's the key to being a great photographer is to actually understand that at the heart level and what that really means in our images. And over the next few podcasts, that's what we're going to be doing. So fantastic. Keep a listen out, and away we go.
Excellent. Thank you, Shelton.
No worries. Thank you.
And I'll leave you to get on with your day. I know you've got other appointments.
Yes. and so many things to do. And next week, of course, I'll also give you a full report on what happened at the Photo and Imaging Technology Expo. I don't know why they chose that name, because photo and imaging should just be on fine. We shouldn't need the word technology. Photography is not about technology. It's important to photography, but it's not about photography. But anyway, I'll shut up on that.
We need to know how many megapixels there are.
Yes, this has got 42 megapixels. Great. I'll also be talking to the good people at Gorillapod here in Australia, and see if we can get to the bottom of this little dilemma. So hopefully we'll have something positive for you, all you winners of the great little Gorillapod next week.
Yeah. One thing I've been meaning to say over the last couple of weeks is Shelton's mentioned a couple of times that, you know, people have sent images and he sort of said, you know, if it's okay with you, we'll put them on the website. And I just wanted to remind people, and we said this way, way back, probably around about episode 5 of Shutters Inc., that if you send us an image, the assumption is that you are happy for it to go on the website unless you specify otherwise. So we won't be asking in future.
Great. Fair enough.
I think everyone's pretty cool with that anyway.
So. If you've look and mention it in your email if you've got a problem.
Yeah,
with
absolutely.
It. How about that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
And if we do put it up and you don't want it up there, then just drop us an email and we'll take it off. That's not a problem either. So
that's right. I'll get the lawyers into it. That's whatever.
All right, mate. You have a good day.
Thanks, buddy.
I'll talk with you next week.
You bet. See you soon.
See ya.
Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.